Well, it's about 12 weeks away from the Passover. Days of unleavened bread. I guess we're about halfway through from the last of God's holy days. You know, the winter season, if this is called winter. Anyway, it's the season that's the longest between God's holy days. I think it is rather interesting to note that perhaps it is the time when, as a result of not observing any of those days, that it would lead to the greatest danger on our part of not understanding or not keeping fully in mind what the plan of God is. And perhaps it is during the winter season that people more frequently forget the goal of a Christian, what God's overall plan is, and this type of thing. So I thought it might be good today to take a look into the story and view it a little bit differently, perhaps, than what has been told before. I want to begin in a rather unusual place, because I think most of us, if we think of the Exodus, the time, the days of unleavened bread, the Passover, and Moses, the children of Israel being brought out of Egypt, we think of the book of Exodus and going back to that account. But in brief summary of that particular period of history, which you can read about, I think we need to take note of the fact that the Creator was specifically dead set against something when He dealt with Egypt, and that was their God. Now, they're not like our society today that has supposedly one God. The Egyptians were not prejudiced in that way. They had many. They worshipped just about anything you can mention. And from Numbers chapter 33, verse 4, we find that God, when He delivered the 10 plagues on Egypt, He did it specifically to take exception to and destroy the idols, that is, the gods of the Egyptians. That is the reason that He gave them the plagues He did. Now, it's interesting to go through those plagues from the point of view of history and find out what the Egyptians worshipped and what God then showed them was not worth worshipping. You know, you worship frogs and lice, and then you get a plague of them, it's not too nice. You think there's something special in blood, you drink it, and then God gives you more to drink, and that doesn't become too funny. And you worship the beast, you know, the cattle and the field and so on like that, and all the livestock, and then God begins to kill them and make them dead around you and to stink up the land. And all the various plagues that God poured out on them had the effect of taking exception to the gods that the Egyptians were worshiping. Excuse me. Now, it's mentioned in two places. It's also mentioned in Exodus chapter 12, verse 12. You can check out the story if you don't think I'm telling the truth. But the reason I mentioned it was, why do you think God went to such a great extent that He did to take exception to these people and what they worshiped? Was it for their sake? Did He think, well, boy, I'll set those Egyptians straight. Well, when I get through pouring out these 10 plagues on them, they'll never be idolaters again. No, I don't think that was the lesson in the story. I think there was another group of people that were to learn something from that. Why did God pour out the first, was it, 3 or 4 plagues on Egypt in the land of Goshen? I mean, you know, here He is, the great God, the Creator. He knows they're in slavery for several centuries. Then when He begins to deliver them, lo and behold, the first thing He does is come down and He gives them the same treatment that He's giving their enemies. I mean, how would you feel? You know, God begins to call you out of this world, and He starts delivering plagues on the world so He can deliver you out, and He starts delivering on your house the same plagues that He's delivering on all those around you. I mean, would you think you were cut out for deliverance? I don't think you would. You'd think in terms, hey, what's He doing? Okay, the lesson then comes down to us in the fact that God was trying to teach Israel. And why was He trying to teach Israel that He was the supreme God? Well, I want to go to a different place than you would think that we need to start this story, found in Ezekiel chapter 20. And you're going to say, well, boy, that's just not the place to start the story of the Exodus. This guy must really be mixed up. Well, actually, we've got 12 weeks to go, so maybe we have time to get straightened out here. But in Ezekiel chapter 20, we find, and Ezekiel was very specific about the dating of his book. I have written in my inspired margin that this was in 590 B.C. when this was written, so perhaps that's the date. But here we have an account in the first number of verses of Ezekiel 20 of the elders of Israel coming to inquire of God. And they sat down before Ezekiel, and God didn't take too kindly to that. Now, that's kind of surprising at first look, because you'd think, well, certainly God would be happy if his leaders came to approach him and approach his prophet and to ask guidance and to inquire and to say, well, what's God say? You know, normally we'd say, hey, that's good. These men are at least religious. They're trying to seek out God, and isn't that nice? Isn't that good? Isn't that commendable? Isn't that wise? Well, God didn't seem to think so. Now, to give you some background to the story, God reacted, and I want to turn back to Ezekiel chapter 14 to show you why he reacted the way he did in chapter 20, to show you the way he reacted. Very interesting story. You go back to chapter 14, and we'll find that certain of the elders again came, or previously, came to Ezekiel, and they were sat down before him. And God said in verse 3, Son of man, these men set up their idols in their own hearts, and they put a stumbling block of their iniquity before their face. Should I be inquired at all of them? Now, I could go back further and give you the story where God had shown Ezekiel what these men were doing in private, how they were worshiping idols and how they were doing some of the most abominable things, and yet they still had the audacity in the light of day to come and seek out the prophet and to inquire, as though God didn't know what they were doing, what he wanted them to do. And so God says very specifically in verse 4, Therefore speak unto them and say unto them, Thus says the Eternal God, every man of the house of Israel that sets up idols in his heart. Notice it doesn't have to be literal. It doesn't have to be made out of wood, out of gold, out of stone, whatever. But he says, if ye do it in his heart, puts the stumbling block of his iniquity before his face, and then comes to the prophet. That's what God was upset about. That I, the Eternal, will answer that individual that comes according to the multitude of his idols. In other words, he's going to be dealt with, and I'm going to deal with him. That's what God is saying. So when the elders came, and these elders were not righteous men, but rather they were idolaters. They had different gods. And God has always taken exception to Israel when they came, not because they would come and seek him. That wasn't what he was taking exception to. But every time that Israel came and tried to mix the true worship with the false worship of other nations. And we're going to see that was at the heart and the core of causing the Israelites the distress that they did, even while they were yet in Egypt. It is a most amazing story. Now, perhaps if we could see the parallel today, it is not the fact that we worship God on the Sabbath that makes God mad. It is not the fact that we obey the statutes and the laws of God that makes God mad. The reason he gets so angry with us for doing those things is that the other things we do in our mind, where he knows we're not number one, or he's not number one in our book, so to speak. And that was the same problem here. And it's one that I think is a very great challenge to a Christian in the 20th century. Now, going back to Ezekiel's account in chapter 20, God says, As I live, verse 3, says the Eternal, I will not be inquired of by you. Now, that seems very strange. It says, Will you judge them? Son of man, speaking to Ezekiel, will you judge them? Cause them to know the abomination of their fathers. Now, why would he want to do that? Because they were doing the same thing. Now, didn't Nathan use this with David? Now, if he'd gone up to say, David, now, hey, I have a bone to pick with you. Now, you just sit down there and listen. I'm going to tell you what kind of a person you're like. He didn't do that. God was smarter than that. And so through Nathan, he gave him what? A story to judge. A story about a rich man and a poor man. And what they did. And David got so mad when it was an objective example, he could see clearly how to judge it. But he couldn't see clearly in his own life how to judge it. So, now, if we can receive also again the point, because I can go through, and there are many scriptures in the New Testament, but some that are very specific to show us that if we can take an objective lesson from history of our forefathers, and if we can see that clearly what they did, then it will be of a great advantage for us, and God won't have to speak to us directly as to what we're doing, because we'll be able to learn from our forefathers. And that's exactly what he wants. And that's why he's written this account for us here today. Because normally the person would say, well, this doesn't have anything to do with us, does it? I'm sure those elders sat down before the prophet Ezekiel, what's this guy all upset about? Why is he talking to us about our forefathers? We know all that history. Out of here with that. We didn't come to hear history lessons. We came to ask God what he said us, what he thinks that we should do today and tomorrow and the next day. Of course, if they'd been listening, that message was in there too. It was very clear. But they didn't get that out of it. Notice, and say unto them, thus says the Lord, in the day that I chose Israel and lifted up my hand unto the seed of the house of Jacob, verse 5 here, made myself known unto them in the land of Egypt when I lifted up my hand to them, saying, I am the eternal your God. In other words, you have accepted in previous centuries because of tradition and because of compulsion the gods and the idols of Egypt. And I'm telling you this day that I've made everything there is, and there is no God besides me, and I want you to lay all that aside. In the day I lifted up my hand, verse 6, to bring them forth out of the land of Egypt, that unto a beautiful land. No, the land was flowing with milk and honey, the glory of all lands. God had picked the best land that he said, okay, I'm going to bring these people out and I'm going to establish them in the best land that there is. I said to them, verse 7, this is paramount. Notice what he said. I said, put away your idols, the abomination of every man that he has before his eyes. He said, don't defile yourself with the idols of Egypt. Because I'm pouring out 10 plagues that are going to destroy that whole nation to show you that I'm greater than those gods are. And I want you to learn something by that. But what do we find? Verse 8. The fathers rebelled against me. They didn't hear me. They did not, every man, cast away the abomination of their eyes. Neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury on them to accomplish my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. Now this is something when you read Exodus, you don't think about. You don't think, hey, God was thinking about getting rid of those hard-headed, stiff-necked Israelites before they even got across the Nile. That's not something that is obvious from the account. But I'm showing you, this is what I'm starting here. That while they were yet in Egypt, and as God began to give them his holy days and his statutes while they were yet in Egypt, they set a record that they didn't do God's will, and that was a continuous record down through their history. But notice, God says, I was ready to get rid of them before I even started. Now, that's something that you just don't get from the story of the Exodus, ordinarily. You just don't think in terms, well, God, he was about ready to not take them out of Egypt by night. He was about ready not to let them cross the Red Sea. Why, that whole episode wouldn't even have happened if God had carried out his anger. Notice what it says, verse 9. But I wrought or worked for my name's sake, that it should not be polluted before the heathen among whom they were, in whose sight I had made myself known unto them. Notice. Because I did this thing publicly before all the nations, before the Egyptians, before the whole world. I took exception to every idol and every false god of the Egyptians, and I destroyed them. 10 plagues. I put down the whole religious system of the entire nation, and I destroyed it. And I did it publicly so that, you know, the Assyrians would take note. The Babylonians would take note. And whoever else lived anywhere on the face of the earth would take note. And know that the greatest nation on the face of the earth went nose down because they idol worshiped. That's what God says. They said, since I did this publicly, now this is a great principle. Because there are certain things that we need to do publicly, and there are certain things that need to be handled in private. Now God was dealing with his children here, and he was on public display before the world. His family was involved and they were not handling things right. But you know what God did? For the sake of his reputation and for the sake of discretion, he didn't handle it publicly. Now there are certain things that need not be handled publicly. And I can say that maybe when your children act out and maybe when they do things that are very embarrassing, or maybe your mate in a public way does something that embarrasses you, you ought not retaliate publicly. There's a time behind closed doors, discreetly, to communicate on these areas. And I can remember being warned of my parents on certain occasions that I had kicked up my heels. And when we got in the vehicle afterward, I was warned there was impending doom because of my behavior. And I learned that, hey, you know, not as all free as you thought it was. And you need to be discreet when you're in the public area, because later on, you will have a price to pay if you don't watch yourself. That is why. And God did that with his people. But notice, what I want to make sure that you understand is that God said, okay, even while they were yet in Egypt, he said, in case I'm doing this thing publicly, I'll have to go through with what I planned, even though it's not what I would like to do because things are not going right. Okay, let's notice back in Exodus chapter 5. Exodus chapter 5 and verse 21. So this is very interesting. Here in this chapter we have Moses and Aaron going into Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's siding with them, and he thought they didn't have enough to do, so he, as you remember, he increased the burdens on the Israelites tremendously. He had them beaten because they weren't bringing in a sufficient quota of bricks, and they weren't being given any more straw to make it. Verse 21, notice the reaction of the elders of Israel at that time, because they had met with Pharaoh. Verse 19, they were in an evil case. You know, that's just like us with the attorney general. We knew he was doing things that were illegal. We were in a bad way. We couldn't do anything about them. The Israelites were in the same way. But notice when they met Moses and Aaron, ooh, if looks could kill. Verse 21, and they said to them, the Lord look on you. Ooh, this is a strong language here. The Lord look on you and judge, because you've made our favor to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Of course, Moses was deeply afflicted by the situation, and he said, well, God, you know, I mean, here, we come out here to deliver these people, and all you've done is just do them the disservice of increasing their burdens and their slavery, and now they hate us exceedingly. And so he was very upset, and God said, well, he said, I have a plan in mind here, and he says, don't worry about it, because old Pharaoh's going to get mighty sick of you before you're done with him, and he's going to cast you out, and you're not going to come out empty. Well, we come down in chapter 6 to verse 9, and here Moses spoke to the children of Israel. He gave them God's communication, you know, about the fact they were going to be delivered, and God was calling them out to be a special people. He was calling them out to put them in the most beautiful land on the face of the earth, and you should have heard what they told him. Of course, it's not printed here. They probably... It's the kind of language, you know, that you wouldn't want to print. And they said to Moses, so the children of Israel were so upset they wouldn't even listen to him because of the anguish of spirit and because of the cruel bondage. So they were deeply upset and very angry, and they wouldn't even discuss it with Moses. And Moses, in that sense, was deeply upset too, because they wouldn't listen to him. And he said to God, well, Pharaoh won't listen to me either. Okay, that's the beginning of the story, but as we go further on here, I'll hearken back to that. That happened in Egypt, and like I say, God was not well pleased with his people even before he got them out of there. But we come down to another case here where the Exodus does take place, and they start down the road. Now, I'm just going to go back to Ezekiel 20 for a moment and read that to you, because here again we find an interesting account of what God said to them after he got them on the way out of Egypt. Notice what he said, verse 10 of Ezekiel 20. He said, wherefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt, to bring them into the wilderness. Verse 11 of Ezekiel 20, and I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. In other words, these things were for their good. These were blessings. He said, even more than that, I not only gave them my laws, my statutes, he said, I went one better than that. I gave them something sacred. I gave them something so valuable, so personal, so intimate, that they were to be my children. Verse 12, I gave them my Sabbath. Notice that, plural? As a sign. A sign is a supernatural identifying proof between me and them. Notice, God knows who his people are, but sometimes his people forget who they are. So God has to remind them by a sign. And you probably don't think of it in those terms of you, as you observe the Sabbath, that you've got a mark, but you have, in your forehead and in your right hand today. because of your knowledge of God's Sabbath, so that they might know that I am the Eternal that sanctify them, that is, that makes them what they should be. But, notice verse 13, even when he did all these things for Israel, they rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes, they despised my judgments, which if a man do, he'll even live in them. Now, what's this telling you? This is a very interesting little verse. It parallels very much with Proverbs, the first chapter. God says, if you reject me, I'll make you live with the rejection. Just whatever you choose, I'll make you live by it. If you choose my law, then you'll live by it. I'll see to it that you get the results of living by my law. But if you reject my law, I'm going to see to it that you get the results of living by that rejection. And we can come over here. I'll just jump ahead in the story to verse 25. There came a point after the wilderness in the promised land, after a number of years, verse 25 of Ezekiel 20, that God gave them over to statutes that were not good. That is, he gave them over to their own statutes. They rejected his, and he gave them over to their own judgment. Wherefore they should not live. Judgments that would cause death. Isn't that amazing? Now, people say, well, why would God do such a mean thing? Well, when you understand this chapter, it's quite obvious. Because they wouldn't do it his way, he said, okay, we'll do it your way. You don't want to live by my statutes and live abundantly and fruitfully and happily? Say, fine, we'll do it your way. You select your abominations, you select your judgments, and we'll see how quickly you die by them. And that's exactly the experiment that he ran with ancient Israel. But I want you to notice his anger. He said, in the wilderness they rejected me, they defiled my Sabbath, and then I said, and this is in verse 13, I will pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to consume them. And you know he would have? Several occasions he was willing to take Moses and make a great nation out of Moses' children. But Moses resisted that. And notice verse 14, but I worked or wrought for my namesake, that it should not be polluted in the sight of the heathen, in whose sight I brought them out. And so he lifted up his hand in the wilderness. There again, he got upset at them. He was not going to bring them into the land flowing with milk and honey, because they despised his judgments. They didn't walk in his statutes. They polluted his Sabbath, and their heart has gone after their idols. And then you come to verse 17, where his eye spared them from destroying them completely. He didn't destroy them completely in the wilderness, but he came very close. And the lesson again that you would not get from just reading the book of Exodus, unless you had this as a summary chapter, is to realize what percentage of the Egyptians do you think God killed? Well, I don't know. How many here are firstborn? Can you see your hand? How many are firstborn? Okay, we'd have a number of deaths in this room. Okay, say, for instance, every family had two children. Well, let's say in certain cases, the parents were not firstborn, so they wouldn't die. But in every family, you'd have at least one firstborn if they had any children. So you'd have one death of an adult, of a person. That doesn't even count the animals. Okay, supposing one or both of the parents were firstborn, you could have two, maybe three deaths in one family. Or if several families were living together, you start dealing with multiples of that. Now, I don't know whether it's even possible to suggest, you know, how many children were the Egyptians having at that time? I don't know what the population was, whether they're having three, five, however many children they were having. But the death of the firstborn killed a high percentage of that nation. More than we realize. It was a plague that went through and didn't spare one household. And I don't know how many children they were having, but you know, even if they were having, say, four children, and say one parent was the firstborn, and you got two deaths out of a family of six. So you got one third dying in that family. So you know, I mean, you're talking about maybe a fifth, maybe a fourth, maybe even a third of the nation dying. But now, if I was to speculate and tell you that when God brought his people Israel out of Egypt by a mighty hand, by 10 plagues, and by great miracles, that with that generation he was so upset that he ultimately ended up killing 100% of it. It'd be kind of a distressing story to tell you, wouldn't it? You know, when you look on the story of the Exodus, it causes you, when you reflect on these statistics, to wonder who he was delivering. It really does. And that's why he uses this example in Ezekiel's time when they had gone into captivity again for the very same reasons of idolatry. And he says, you elders, he says, you guys that are worshiping falsely, he says, you come here to inquire of me, I want you to learn some history. I want to tell you about the way I did your forefathers. And so when you come knocking on my door, you better know what you're in for. You better get your lives straightened up before you come and inquire of me. That was the lesson of Ezekiel 20. But there's a lot to the story. Because when we come to Exodus, we'll find out that there was a series of rebellions, which I just want to go through briefly. The time is going, it'll have to be brief. Exodus chapter 14, verses 10 through 15. This is the story of Pharaoh pursuing after them. Now, last year, Dr. Hay made it very clear in the spring feast that rather than the Israelites coming out of Egypt in one night, the night to be observed, which is the way I always looked at it. I said, you know, it's really great. One beautiful night exit out of the land of slavery. Wow, that's really great. And they came out with their past wages, you know, full of jewels and gold and wages and cattle. And wow, they were loading down. What a time of rejoicing. But as he pointed out, it took them the next 7 days to get beyond the perimeters of the geographical influence of Egypt before God ultimately delivered them on the final day of unleavened bread. And the analogy is the fact that you don't come out of this world in one day. I thought I was about to when I was baptized, and I found there was a whole lot more to the fight of being separate and untainted and unpolluted by this world than just coming out in one day. A very great lesson. But here in Exodus, we are told that, we are told here the conversation that the Israelites had. Notice, Pharaoh drew near, the people were absolutely frightened. They were very frightened, verse 10. And they cried out unto God, which I'm sure was a good thing to do. But also that wasn't all what they did. Verse 11, and they came to Moses, and they had a few mean words for him. Because, in the people's mind, this Moses, this idiot Moses, he was the numbskull that got him in trouble. I mean, he was the one that turned off the path, got him all tangled up down there in that box canyon so the Egyptians could come after them in the first place. So notice the view of the people. The people didn't say, well, Jesus Christ, our Creator, that God, the Lord of creation, is leading this multitude. They didn't think that way. Are you kidding me? Oh, we've got people the same way today. They say, that Armstrong outfit, that Church of God, you're kidding me. God's not leading this thing. God would do that? God's so stupid as to lead his people down into a box canyon? Are you crazy? And so they said this to Moses. They said, because there's no graves in Egypt, that's why you brought us out here in this wilderness. And why did you deal with us this way to carry us forth out of Egypt? That was your idea, Moses. Now, I don't read that previously. You know, when they were collecting all the back wages, I don't read where they went to Moses and said, I don't think this is a good idea. When the night to be observed comes and they went out with a high hand in haste, I don't find the Israelites gathering around Moses and Aaron saying, what do you guys mean taking us out of Egypt? I find there was shouting and rejoicing and they got on out of there quickly. They were free. But this is a little further down the trail, you know, toward the days of unleavened bread, toward the end of it. And notice, they said, verse 12, isn't this the word that we told you while we were yet in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? Well, I don't think they said it that way.
I don't find that recorded back there. I find recorded back where they got so upset with Moses because he'd made them to stink in the eyes of Pharaoh that they wouldn't even talk to him. But I don't find back there where they said, well, you leave us alone, we'll serve the Egyptians. I think the idea of getting out from under the Egyptian bondage was a favorable idea in their sight. For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in this wilderness. So that was their argument. And of course, Moses encouraged them, told them to stand still. Now, you know, when they got mad at Moses in Egypt because of the rigorous bondage, you know, I think God can understand that. I think he could see that under severe duress that sometimes a person will do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. And sometimes we will. Sometimes under severe pressure, we will retrogress and we overcame something and it'll come back on us. We'll start doing it again. We'll say, I worked on that 10 years ago. God overcame it. Now it's back plaguing me again. I can't believe this happened to me. So, you know, that's a good lesson. But you know, in this case, they were scared stiff. And so, I'm sure that God, in that sense, had a bit of mercy and compassion. He told Moses, you know, go ahead, get them out of there, get them across the Red Sea. So Moses did it. And Moses had courage and faith at that time in God, so everything turned out real good. Well, we come down to chapter 15 here. We read in the story where they were very excited. In fact, we have a song here that Moses composed, and they had the music appropriately done. Miriam the prophetess led the ladies out in a dance, apparently, in thanksgiving to God. So it was a time of great rejoicing and thanksgiving. But even after the miraculous deliverance from the army, now how big an army do you suppose that was? Now Israel had, in the census, what, about 600,000 men above 20? So probably a company of about 2.5, maybe 3 million people altogether came out of Egypt. Maybe larger than that, I don't know. What type and what size of an army do you think it would be to go out and meet 600,000 men, even though they weren't armed like an army, and several million people to bring them back under slavery? Well, here we come down, verse 23. Here we find they came to Mirah, and they could not drink the waters there because the waters were somehow unsuitable, bitter, poisonous, whatever. Anyway, the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And of course, Moses was upset, and he said, well, God has got to have an answer. So he cried to God, and God showed him a tree. And here's where we come up to the beginning of the healing covenant with God's people, where God promised in a statute and in an ordinance. And I think we need to take note of that, that it is a statute and an ordinance of God with his people. Even back here where they didn't have the Holy Spirit, that he would be their healer and that he would be the source of their health and that he would not bring on them the diseases of Egypt. That's a very interesting thing. But notice, they came out, they murmured, they got upset. Now this was 3 days after they had seen a vast Egyptian army have all the water to drink it needed, and then some, drowned in the Red Sea. And they walked through dry shod. And 3 days down the road, they were thirsty. And Moses was the dummy who was supposed to give them water. Now, can you say, well, they didn't have much foresight. They didn't realize who was leading them, did they? They didn't know that God was there. And I guess you could fault God and Christ, because he was the one, he was the God of the Old Testament. He'd say, well, he sure didn't lead those people very well. I guess he didn't know the geography. He kind of got out there in the sands of the wilderness, got a bit mixed up himself, went 3 days' journey, had to look around, scout out some water. It took him a while to find it, took him a while to bring it around. Was that it? No. He specifically wanted them to get thirsty enough to see what would do to their attitude. And it didn't do good things to them. It made them mad. But they still didn't get the picture. Well, we go on. Exodus 16, verse 2. They took their journey here. We find the whole congregation of Israel began to murmur against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. They said, would to God that we died at the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. Now, I guess they began by this time to get a bit of an inkling because of their attitude that God was upset about things enough back even in Egypt that he was going to destroy them. So they said, well, I wish he'd done it back there instead of out here. We go through tough times and we look back and we say, well, I wish God never called me. Yeah, I can't understand why he'd do that. You know, I wish he just would have kept his miserable hands off me. Left me alone. I mean, this is so hard. I just should have been left in the world. So they said, wish to God that we died back in Egypt. Where we now notice this. This is what they had on their mind. Why are we sat by the flesh pot? Well, that's not what they said when they were there in Egypt. They said, we're under rigorous bondage. We even have to go out and gather the straw to make these bricks. We haven't got enough time in a day to meet our quotas. What do you mean they were sitting around by the flesh pot? Does that tell you something about the way human nature views its past? You can go through a difficult trial, and you can complain all the way through it, and then you can look back on it when something else comes on. You say, well, it wasn't too bad. Human nature is unreal. This is not out of date. I said, where we did eat bread to the full, you brought us out from, brought forth in this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So here again, God caused them to go hungry, and they got very upset. Again, with the men that they saw rather than with God that they didn't see. And of course, then God was about to test them and try them as to whether or not they would obey him or not. And so he specifically did this, again, to test his people. Well, you come down here, there was a lot of murmuring. God heard the murmuring. He wasn't happy about it. You can read the account. But we come down here to the point where God did give his instructions concerning manna, and Moses passed them along to the people. Well, sure enough, the people began to view this thing, and we found that Moses said, well, each man go out and gather whatever manna you need, whatever your household needs, and that's fine. You gather it up in the morning. You have bread in the morning, but don't try and keep it over to the next day because you need to go out there daily and gather it up. And this was a unique kind of bread. I've never discovered this recipe since. It's the kind of bread, the only time it wouldn't rot was Friday night. It's a very unique kind of bread. And interestingly enough, though, verse 20, just because Moses said that didn't mean the people said, oh, well, Moses knows what he's talking about. He understands this manna. No, they said, well, let's go out and see. And so they got the bread and they kept it over. They said, well, we'll see whether it'll stink or not. And it bred worms and stank because they kept it over. Moses was very upset with that because he knew they were not obeying him. And they weren't obeying God, the instructions that God had given him. Well, they failed on that. Then we come down to the Friday night situation. And, of course, the instructions there were, well, keep it over, double the amount you need. And, of course, people said, well, you're stupid, man. What a dummy. I mean, we have tried that. Why, we went out and we gathered a week's supply, and you know what happened? Why, it bred worms and stank, and we had to throw the whole thing out and start all over again. And you idiot, you stand up there and you're telling us, well, this is going to be different because it's Friday. He said, we're not going for that garbage. And so they just gathered probably enough for Friday. They said, well, we're going out there Saturday morning and gather us up this bread, no problem with that. So they did. They got themselves into bad trouble. And they went out there. Verse 27, and it came to pass that there went some of the people out on the seventh day, and they, of course, didn't find any. So they wasted their efforts. They probably went hungry for the day, didn't feel too happy about the whole thing, got in a very negative, miserable attitude about the whole thing. Well, God said, how long are you going to refuse to keep my commandments? That's a very simple thing. But, you know, it didn't make sense. So simple and yet so stupid, because they had tried it and it stank, and they tried to preserve it during the week, and yet lo and behold, on the day of preparation, it didn't. And they just said, well, that is just unreal. So they didn't believe God. They had to suffer it through and find out from experience. Well, we come down to chapter 17 then. Here things got very serious. Because they began to chide with Moses. We read about it here. They were very upset. There was no water again. They were out of water. They were very upset. And they even began, in this case, to tempt God. Because, you see, in the last time, Moses had informed them, well, hey, you know, you're not just upset at me, you better be careful. And they murmured, verse 3, against Moses, and they again, now they begin to get a little more detailed in their complaints. Notice this, this is interesting. You have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle. So they get a little more specific in their complaining and griping. And Moses cried unto the Eternal. He said, what shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. So this one got into a very nasty mob situation. Of course, God said, you take the elders out and you do the thing over there at the rock, you smite it, and water will come out. And now Moses did that. But the place was called Massa and Meribah, because that means temptation and chiding. And I want you to take note of here, they tempted God, verse 7, saying, notice what they said in tempting God. Well, is God here or isn't he? And that is very apropos for today. When the church takes situations into hand or goes a direction that we get upset with, we say, well, is God leading this outfit, or isn't he? And that's a statement you better be careful with, because it's been made by certain of your ancestors with very much disagreement and disharmony with God. And so, of course, we get into the situation where their attitude was very, very bad there. And, of course, God was keeping count of these situations. God was keeping count of these situations. We come on down now to... I'm going to have to jump over quite a number of chapters, because the book of Exodus now covers a considerable amount of the Old Covenant. In fact, I might just give that to you, the Old Covenant from chapter 19 through 24, verse 8. And it includes not only the Ten Commandments, but of course many statutes and various laws and ordinances and judgments that God gave to his nation. And as Mr. Armstrong made it quite evident here recently, saying that there were four laws, four basic laws that were given to Israel. But this is not the place to explain that. But that might be interesting to you in the future. But notice, and I'll come down and just summarize, in chapter 31, God specifically, in verse 13 of chapter 31, made a special, separate, holy covenant regarding time of Sabbath to be a supernatural identifying sign with the house of Israel. So that's what he did there in that particular case. And then we come to a situation in 32 after Moses had gone up the mountain to receive instructions from God. We find the people now. Notice, Moses was delayed. You know, he was out of town. Chapter 32, verse 1. And they came together to Aaron. Now, Aaron didn't have things all together at this time. He said, up, make us God, which shall go up before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. Something that has happened in our day today. And perhaps we can look back at certain of those who over the last period of 13 years, perhaps, have taken upon themselves very similar statements to this. And they said, well, you know, this old man, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, I mean, you know, obviously, he's gone up to 300 years or 300 days a year, could just as well be years, because he's never around. We can't get his authorization or his signature on any papers. We can't seek any counsel or advice from him. I mean, it's very obvious he's out of town and he's gone. So we don't know what's become of him. He's gone. So let's go to now and let's form us a policy. Let's shape up the organization according to more traditional lines, so that we can have good growth and good success, and so that it will grow. And let's set out a form of doctrine which will make it easier for people to come on into the church, you know, the STP, and we'll sort of lubricate things with this STP. That'll bring people in, and we'll have more money and a greater work and more reputation, this type of thing. Can you see the parallels? This is not out of date at all. This is absolutely up to the moment. Well, Aaron said, you know, break off your earrings, bring your ornaments, and it ended up being a golden calf. Aaron, when he explained this to Moses, really didn't know how it happened. I always enjoy that account, you know. He just sort of dumped the earrings over in a pile, and up came this calf. Didn't really know how to explain that. It just sort of happened. Things get out of hand just sort of that way. But it's interesting here. The people really had rejected Moses, and in essence, they'd rejected God as their leader. Now, I would suggest to you that God could have done this a lot more intelligently. That is, humanly intelligently. I mean, 40 days without a leader? That's a little bit ridiculous, isn't it? You mean God would actually take away your leader for a while and see what you do about it? You mean to tell me that God would allow a vacuum of leadership just to see what was on people's minds? To see who would abide continually in what they'd received and who would not? Well, that doesn't seem too intelligent to me. God allowed it. God did it. And there were those who were carried away by it. But it's very interesting that we come down here in this situation that God was so upset when he saw what was happening. You can read about it in verse 6. The people got down to eating and drinking finally. I guess there was enough finally to eat and drink. And they said, well, let's really throw a party. And they did, and I believe it was something like about 23,000 that ended up dying on this occasion. But they got things totally out of hand. They corrupted themselves, and of course they broke God's laws concerning marriage and the family at this occasion. And God was very upset, and he sent Moses rambling right back down the mountain. Of course, Moses got so upset. You can read the account in detail. And God got so upset, he said to Moses, I believe this is the occasion where he said, get out of the way, stay away from these people. I've seen this people. Behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Let me alone. You know, don't restrain me any, Moses, that my wrath may wax hot against them. I'll consume them, and I'll make you a great nation. Boy, what a test. I'll tell you, what a test to Moses. Because Moses could have said, sure. Right on. We will go ahead with this plan, God. I can envision my sons and my daughters. Now, Moses must have been very wise, because if he really was, you know what he would have said in his mind? I don't care, God, whether you use those Israelites or whether you use my children over here. You got the same people. You got a stiff-necked, hard-headed, rebellious lot. And unless you're merciful, they're going to die. And so Moses went to God and he said, hey, no way, this is not good. He said, you've done this action publicly. He said, God, you can't do this. You can read about it in verses 11 and 12. He said, wherefore should Egypt would speak about this? And he said, well, God brought them out. It was obvious that he said he was the great creator. But you know, he only got half through this job and then he turned it down. And then they talk against you that you're not really the greatest God. You're not really the great creator. And so in verse 14, God repented of the evil that he intended. And he said, okay, you know, you've calmed me down on this matter. That's fine. And so Moses got right down to take care of the problem. Then we come down to verse 28. Now, whether you've detected this from the account, I'll point this out as we go through here. This was where the tribe of Levi, because there are family characteristics that are inherited. This is where the family of Levi actually came to illustrate the character necessary to be the priests of God in the nation of Israel. Notice it. Moses stood up, verse 26, and said, hey, who's going to be on God's side? Come over here. Well, the entire tribe of Levi did. They stood together on this matter, and they said, we were not for this golden calf idea at all. And it's interesting to me that later on in history, when, guess who, Jeroboam set up the golden calf, he punished the Levites by rejecting their leadership. Because their leadership, Satan worked in Jeroboam's mind to say, they'll follow God, they'll be faithful priests. You're going to have to get rid of them as faithful priests. What a lesson. Same in the church today. Any priest, any minister who will be faithful, sure as anything, the devil will come along and say, how can we get rid of that rat? There's a lot more pressure on a true minister to be gotten rid of than there is on the politicians. The politicians don't have trials. It's the true ministers that get kicked out And we see that in recent history. Some of the men, the evangelists, and some of the high-ranking ministers put down. Faithful men, loyal men, men of truth. But here's where the Levites qualified as ministers, because they said, following God is greater than living in harmony with the other tribe. We don't go along with their mischief. And they had to prove their point by going out and killing their relatives. Not their immediate relatives, I guess, in that sense, but people of the other tribes who had corrupted themselves. So it's quite a lesson. And then Moses said to God that he acknowledged the sin of the people in verse 31, and he said, if you'll forgive them, fine. If you won't, he said, this is where I end it. He said, you may as well kill me. Because, and he just came to the point where he knew God was so upset about this thing, he said, notice, this is a great act of leadership on Moses' behalf, because he put his life on the line for the sake of his people. Here's where he became a great shepherd in the sight of God, because he was willing to die for those people, even though they were wrong. And it kind of gives you the type of Christ at this point, where this man was willing to say, look, God, I know you're full of wrath. You hate what's happened, so do I. He said, if you can't see your way to forgive these people, then, you may as well cash my future in too, because this is as far as I'm going. Well, God said to Moses, well, whosoever sins against me, him will I blot out of my book. Go ahead, you lead these people. And God plagued the people, though, because they'd made the calf. And that was a difficult situation for them. Okay, we come down to 33, then we find that because of this, God told Moses, depart, and he said, I'll send the angel in before you to clear out the land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up in the midst of you. In other words, I came so close this last time. The way these people are, he said, as sure as they do something else, they're such a stiff-necked people, he said, I'll break forth in anger and I'll kill a whole lot of them. And so you can see God here putting a boundary on his own temper, on his own anger. Now, he has perfect control, but he doesn't compromise with sin. So he said, that's it. I'm not going to dwell in the midst of Israel any longer. Well, the people got in all in a snit about that, and when they heard that, they all mourned and they put aside their ornaments. Now, they didn't do that, apparently, in real repentance. They did it because they were stiff-necked, and they just wanted to try and in a sulk, force God to come back in the midst of them. But from that time forth, well, Moses went outside the camp to talk to God, because God separated himself from the camp of the Israelites. So it was a rather interesting account. Well, we come down here to... now, I'm going to have to skip again, way ahead in the story, to take you all the way through... the rest of Leviticus through Numbers up until chapter 11. And here we find the Israelites in a state of difficulty. We find that they had again complained, and it displeased God. God heard it, and his anger was kindled, and he started consuming the outer posts of the camp where the complaining was going on. And, of course, the people cried out, and there was a fire there, and, of course, God stopped it. But what's significant about this, and I think one thing that is very much a parallel in the church today, is that there was a mixed multitude among them, a mixed multitude that they were not all genuine people. Just as the Scripture says, there are those that are with us that are not of us. Well, they fell to lusting. That's a good way to put it. But notice, it also had an effect on the children of Israel, verse 4. And they began to weep again, began to feel sorry for themselves, and began to say, well, who's going to give us flesh feed? Now notice, way back there when God was proving them, before he gave them the old covenant, he was proving them on manna, and he said at that occasion, I didn't read it, but it's back there, you can find it, in Exodus, where he said, look, I'm going to give these people bread in the morning and meat at night. Now, we come all the way down here to Numbers before the thought ever comes up again. You know what he did? He waited till the people got so hungry and so upset. Now, notice this account. It's a beautiful verse 5. We remember the fish that we did have in Egypt, of course, was the Nile River, obviously. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, oh, the onions and the garlic. All these fine things that we had down there in Egypt, and our soul now is dried up. All we get is this stinking bread. No meat, no variety to our diet. What's God trying to do? Bring us out here on a starvation diet? Yeah, doesn't he love us? Doesn't he care for us? And then it gives a description in verses 7 and 8 of manna. And of course, Moses heard the people weep throughout their families. Every man, it says, at the door of his tent, verse 10, and the anger of God was greatly kindled, and even Moses himself was exceedingly displeased. So, Moses, you know, now notice how the attitude of complaining. It started at the outskirts of the camp among some malcontents. It goes on through the mixed multitude who set to lusting and thinking, oh, we had the good life back there in Egypt. Now, did they, can you find what they said about themselves back there in Egypt? Were they bragging about it, their slavery? Did they think it was great? Did they have all day to sit by the flesh pots, eat their onions and garlic? No, they were in slavery. But you see, comparatively, when God starts putting some tests and trials on them, they thought they had it so much easier back there in the world. That's directly how we look at it. Satan tries to get us to say, you know, when I was back there in the world, I didn't have any problems. Man, it was clear sailing. I didn't have any persecution. I didn't have all this trouble. I didn't have all this wretchedness. I mean, man, it's just one problem after another. I just get through one trial and difficulty, and lo and behold, there's another one right there. One on top of another. I never had that back in the world. Of course, when you're back in the world, if you really would acknowledge it, you were in a state of slavery, just didn't know it. You're in a state of agony, just couldn't do it. But we can't admit that. Oh, this is a beautiful one. So Moses gets to complaining too. Notice it passed from the mixed multitude to the Israelites who became discontent then when they heard the mixed multitude, and they said, yeah, you guys are right. And then it came right up to Moses, and he began to think of how pity his situation was, and he began to talk to God about it. And he said, and this is beautiful, he said, why are you afflicting your servant, you know, God? What's going on here? Now, was God afflicting Moses? No. But he felt that way about it. He said, if I have found grace in your sight, why do you lay the burden of all this people on me? He said, if I conceived them, if I begotten them, are they my children? Am I a nursing father? Oh, he's really going on here, making a big story out of it. I'm sure God appreciated that in the sense that Moses was trying to care for them. You know, Moses came so involved with those people, their complaints and their problems, that he began himself to lose sight of God. Notice what it says. And now all the people, he says, how am I going to provide food for this multitude? They want flesh feeds. He says, we don't have enough in our flocks and our herds to do all that. And so he says, kill me. Moses gets desperate. Takes the suicide route here. Well, God saw that it was heavy on Moses, and so he said, well, I'll give the elders your same attitude. I'll pour out my spirit on them so you'll have some help, and so all the congregation as well as the elders won't be against you, Moses, and that'll certainly help you out. And of course it did, verse 17. But notice, God got so upset, he says, okay, flesh? Flesh is what you want, flesh is what you'll get. In verse 19, he says, it won't be one day. I enjoy this. It won't be 2 days. It won't be 5 days or 10. It won't even be 20. It'll be a whole month. Then you're going to get flesh right up to your noses. It's going to be loathsome to you. You're going to have so much flesh because you've despised God and you've complained and made statements that you were sad about coming out of Egypt. So therefore, I'm going to cause this to come to pass. And notice there, Moses lacked the faith, and God says, well, hey, Moses, now I didn't say you were going to have to provide these people flesh. Notice it, verse 21, 22, 23. Said, is the Lord, you know, did I get weak somewhere, Moses? He said, I'm going to provide this thing. So he did. And so we find that verse 31, a great storm of quail came up out of the sea, and we find that it was 2 cubits high. It would be about 18 inches, what, about 36 inches, about 3 feet high. You know, talk about, well, that'd be about hip deep in quail. So the people all stood up on that day. They were greatly excited by this. They began to take in their harvest then. And the ones that lusted after it, God got so upset with them because they didn't even properly dressed the birds and that, and just while it was right in their mouth, God killed them because he was so mad at them, verse 33. And he caused a great plague among the people on that occasion. Okay, I've got to hurry here. I just have one more example here. In chapter 12, we find the occasion, I think it's been commented on previously, so we find Moses was one of the meekest men in the whole earth, and that is the reason he didn't get upset at his older sister and his older brother. He should have. They started accusing him, taking exception to God's work through him, and that shows you, sometimes it's hardest for those people that are closest to Mr. Armstrong to maintain the respect for God, for him, the reverence for God, and the respect for Mr. Armstrong. And so, you know, Miriam, she helped out with Moses when he was just a baby. And she said, well, you know, Moses, he's just my brother. And Aaron said, well, yeah, he's my kid brother. And so they didn't fear God. But Moses, as verse 3 says, was very meek above all men that were on the face of the earth. Moses was so meek, in fact, that God could deal with him without adverse effect, and he could talk to him face to face, and he couldn't do that with others. Excuse me for a moment. So here we find in this account that Moses didn't say anything to his brother and sister, and God had to deal very, very severely with him. In fact, give Miriam a terminal disease, and she had to be without the camp for 7 days, so it was a very great lesson. Okay, but the account I really wanted to get to was that of the spies in chapter 13. We have here God allows them to send out a leader from each tribe to search the land out, and they did so. And as it turned out, they had 10 bad ones and 2 good ones. But in verse 32, we find an evil report comes up. A slanderous report, in fact, as God said a little later, that they brought an evil, slanderous report up about the beautiful land that God was going to give them. And they lied about the situation because God was fully capable of bringing the people in. And see, they neglected to view their history. Obviously, God was able to do it. The Canaanites were not as great as the Egyptians, and God had defeated the Egyptians to bring them out. And so we find that they discouraged the people. And isn't that an amazing effect? Here again, we saw it with the mixed multitude over the flesh. We see it again. The negative report. A negative report can either go up and down the structure in the church. It can start at the base roots and go up the ladder, just like it did, from the outposts of the camp to the mixed multitude, to the Israelites, on up to Moses. It can go on up the line. Or it can start at the top with the leaders, and in this case the spies, and because of their report, disseminate down through the congregation. And the discouraging reports and the slanderous reports caused them to lack faith in God, and they became all discouraged. They murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and the whole thing was upset there. And they said, would to God that we had died in the land of Egypt. Notice, verse 2. Or would to God that we died in this wilderness. Wherefore has God brought us into this land to fall by the sword, and our wives and our children must be victims or hostages? It would have been better for us, would it not be better for us to return unto Egypt? And so they began to start an election to see who they could have take them back into Egypt. Well, the whole situation got out of hand, and God begins to talk about it. And I think it's very interesting that the comments here that Moses tried to encourage them, Joshua and Caleb tried to encourage them, and in verse 11 God says to Moses, how long will this people provoke me? How long will it be before they believe me for all the signs which I have shown them? I will smite them with pestilence and disinherit them and make of you another great nation mightier than they. Again, Moses is challenged with this challenge. And Moses doesn't go for it again. And it's interesting then, Moses begins to reason with God. He says, now, God, if you do that, people all over the world are going to say, you brought your people out, you brought them through the wilderness, but you lacked the power to bring them into the land you promised them. He says, you can't go halfway with this project. You're going to have to see the whole thing through. And so he said, he beseeched God that he would do that. And he said in verse 18, you are long-suffering, of great mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, and no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation, pardon, verse 19, I pray you, the iniquity of these people according to the greatness of your mercy, and forgive this people from Egypt even until now. Because God just kept making allowances right along for them. Okay, the interesting thing is in verse 22, conclusion of the story. I'll start with a little further up. Verse 20, God says, I pardon according to your word. Quite a concession. Again, he accepts the wisdom and counsel of his servant Moses. Because of all these men which have seen my glory, my miracles, which I did not only in Egypt, but also throughout the wilderness, they've tempted me now these 10 times. That's what we've just covered. See, God will put up with a mistake. But you continue in it. And when Israel, as a nation of rebels, neglected to hear his counsel and continued to provoke him 10 consecutive times down through their history, notice what he did. They've not hearkened to my voice. Absolutely, surely, verse 23, they will not see the land that I promised because they've provoked me. Not one of them, except Caleb and, of course, Joshua, because they were different. So God goes on describing them. He said, surely your carcasses will fall in this wilderness because all of you that were numbered, that murmured against me, you're going to find that they're going to fall. And he said, just like you said, it would have been better for you to die in the wilderness. He said, well, I'm just going to take what you said and I'm going to do it to you. The verse 31, your children that you said would be hostages, I'm going to take them. And they are going to know the land that you have despised. And your carcasses are going to fall in the wilderness. Your children are going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years to bear your iniquity until your carcasses are wasted away. And that's where he came up with the principle of a day for a year. Each day that the spies had entered the land and searched it out would be a day in actual fulfillment of punishment of the Israelites. Now, in summary of the story, perhaps we could go back to Ezekiel 20 just for a moment and say and look again at the circumstance. You know, when you first began to hear the story that God would call his people out of Egypt and all the plagues that God did in Egypt up until the killing of the firstborn, which would take a high percentage death toll of the nation, it would almost seem if somebody began the story by telling you and ultimately God's anger because of his people rejecting what he said and failing to see his miracles and his leadership and his government and his righteousness, failing to believe in him so badly, failing miserably 10 consecutive times, that he would ultimately end up killing a greater percent of the population of Israel than he would of the Egyptians. It's kind of unreal, isn't it? Well, I don't know. I didn't figure this out recently. It was just something I had jotted down previously. And I guess I was just taking the figure of the census, which was approximately 600,000 that were above 20 of the men. But I neglected to count the women. And they were among those who rebelled too, anybody who was in the census. So I presumed that they would die out and their children would go on in. So in the wilderness, really, all the wilderness experience was the transition from the parents to the children, the dying out of the parents and the coming to maturity of the children so that God could work with them, train them and teach them and bring them into the promised land. And I worked it out and I think I came out with a figure of approximately 42 deaths per day. So you could double that because it would include the other half as well. So that was what you had throughout the wilderness. People dying by a considerable number because God was against them. And it doesn't say, you know, they weren't dying of old age, but they were dying of various plagues and various difficulties, I guess. I don't know exactly what it was. But to me, it's an incredible story. And then you come back to Ezekiel chapter 20. And time fails me to tell you about the rest of the story. Because you see, we're only half through. I've just covered half of Ezekiel chapter 20. Notice, they rebelled in Egypt. God was going to punish them, but he didn't for his name's sake. He repented. God was going to punish them in the wilderness, but he didn't. He repented. He changed his mind. And then it comes down, his eye spares them, and the rest of the story is with the children. And you can read about that in the remainder of the chapter of Ezekiel 20. Maybe we can tell that story again sometime. But I did want to point out this part of the story of the 10 rebellions of ancient Israel that cost them their opportunity to enter into the promised land. And to suggest to you that they are people, not necessarily unlike us today, afflicted by human nature and by the fallibility of human reasoning, with tempers, with complaints, with tendencies toward murmuring, with tendencies toward rejecting God's miracles and God's leadership, failing to see the invisible hand of God in doing the work that he did during their day. And we can be much the same in our day, failing to sense and to see the hand of God working in our day for the good of his people and for the purpose that he has purposed. And it's an amazing story of how human beings are. Well, we hope better things for you, but perhaps that is the first part in the story as we proceed this year to the Days of Unleavened Bread.